views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to the Conscious Business Radio Network on Transformation Talk Radio. I am hoping you're having a great Monday and you're preparing for Super Tuesday tomorrow. For those of you that watched the Republican debate, I got to tell you, that was it was really funny. But at the same time, I mean, watching Trump, it's funny. I mean, you can't say anything, but it's funny. Some of the things he says is so over the top. But the sad part is these are serious issues. So while it is a really entertaining thing to watch, because you can't believe somebody, a politician, would actually say half the things that he's saying, it's sad, because this is real stuff. I mean, we have some real serious issues that we have to deal with. And so what we're going to talk about today is dealing with a crisis and how you deal with crises in general, whether you're talking your business or a city or a police department or, you know, the government. And today we have the commanding officer from the New York Police Department, NYPD, Officer Keith Singer. He actually is a former commanding officer, but he was in charge of many crises, including he was involved in 9/11, Hurricane Sandy, and the 2003 blackout. And now he has his own company, ICMC Group, which is a crisis management firm that consults with business owners, CEOs, and heads of government on what to do in those kinds of situations. And I think it's really timely. I mean, we have so many issues going on in our country and around the world. I mean, you never know when a crisis is going to occur, whether it's the grid that goes out, whether we have a natural disaster, or whether somebody messes with your internet and your networks, your computers. There's all sorts of possibilities that can cause problems. And every major city, every company really needs to be prepared and what to do. And not just from a physical standpoint, but also how do you deal with the PR of it? How do you make sure that people don't get panic and create more issues? And so you have to look at all the different contingencies that go on. And he's going to explain all that. And it's a really fascinating interview that I have with him. And before we get into that, I just want to remind you that on sarahwestall.com, I have all my past shows, and including this one. I'll have this one up as a podcast so that you can re-listen to it if you want. But go to sarahwestall.com, put comments in there, do whatever you need to do, but you can hear all my shows there, as well as on iTunes and all your favorite podcast players. It's all over the place. We have it on over 90 different channels. So you can reach any of my past shows there. But now I'm going to welcome Keith Singer to the program.
Well, at the NYPD, I had several different functions. When I was a sergeant, I was a patrol supervisor. I was a plainclothes sergeant. And as a lieutenant, I was the commanding officer of Transit Bureau Operations. So exactly what that means is that anything significant that happened in the New York City transit system, I'd be the person who would get the resources, would make sure we had all the manpower. I was also the liaison with the MTA. So for a significant incident such as Hurricane Sandy, I would have my plans. The MTA would have their plans. We'd get together. We'd review both plans together to make sure that we were on the same page. Then I would present that to my chief. My chief would present that to the police commissioner. And obviously with Hurricane Sandy, those plans were then sent to the mayor, and that's what the mayor used at press conferences. So that's exactly what I did on the NYPD.
So you essentially came up with the plans and things, and then that rolled up a couple levels to the mayor, and that's what got rolled out.
That's correct, depending on how significant the incident was.
Well, did you have to deal with crises on a regular basis?
Oh, yeah, I had to deal with crises, a lot of crises on a regular basis, such as personal crisis,
Like, what would be a personal crisis that you would see?
Well, a personal crisis would be a lady saying her husband's, you know, abusing her, and we would have to get the husband out of there, arrest the husband, and then we would have to find a safe location for the wife, for the kids, to make sure that when the husband did get out, he wouldn't go back and do the same thing to the wife. So that would be on the lines of a personal crisis.
And then from a citywide crisis, what kinds of things besides Hurricane Sandy, what other kinds of things did you have to deal with on a citywide level?
During the blackout, I led a team to make sure that everybody was safe, that everybody who was on life support within the geographical area was maintaining their life support, that we didn't have to bring them to the hospital, that no significant crimes were happening during the blackout. I dealt with 911 as well. I dealt with 911. So, yeah, so I dealt with a couple of big issues during the course of my career.
Well, and you were in charge of that for, like, the blackout. You were in charge of that. Now, that's a pretty serious, right? I mean, the government's becoming more concerned with the grid going down, and that was a really good example of what can happen. What kinds of things happened, and were you able to keep problems from spiraling out of control when the blackout occurred?
Yeah, I think what we did on the NYPD, I think we kept a lot of problems spiraling out of control for the blackout, because you have to understand, and also with Hurricane Sandy, when you have the blackout, you don't have any power anywhere. So that means you're not going to have power at the gas stations. You're not going to have some power in buildings where people, again, need to be on life support and things of that nature. And also, you also have to take care of the responsibilities that you have to make sure nobody takes advantage of what's going on, that there's no lights, meaning that nobody's going to, you know, break into stores or take any merchandise that isn't theirs, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, for the blackout, we suppressed a lot of that stuff, and a lot of that stuff didn't happen. I mean, if you ever read regarding the 1970s blackout in New York City, it was much, much different from when I had to handle the blackout in New York City.
And now, why is that? Is that because we just know more? And because
we were better prepared, yes. We were absolutely better prepared.
It was such a disaster back then that we knew what to do.
Yeah, we were definitely better prepared for the second one. We exactly knew where to put all the personnel. We knew exactly where the locations that we might have some problems in, so we could put equipment there, we could put personnel there. So, yeah, we were much, much better prepared for the second one.
Now, what do you think if there, and I know you work with businesses and governments and stuff on how to deal with crises, what is the real threat of a blackout, you know, like a terrorist going after our power grid across the country? I mean, you dealt with it firsthand in New York. What is the likelihood or chance it can happen across our country, and are we prepared nationwide for something like that?
The chances that would happen across the country nationwide is very significant, because you have to understand our power grid isn't the best power grid. Our power grid is very old. It hasn't been updated in a long time. I'm sure it's very easily hacked into. So if a country that was an enemy of ours was able to get into our power grid, they can cause complete chaos. Because I remember during, again, I'm going to bring up Hurricane Sandy. When we didn't have, nobody could get gas at the gas stations, and you saw those lines, if that happens for a prolonged period of time, people eventually have a breaking point. And that breaking point would probably turn everything into chaos. And not to mention, all the infrastructure things that we take for granted, like stoplights and alarms and things of that nature. So we would have none of that. So, yeah, it's very significant. It's something that's very, very real, something that the government, and I've been saying for years, should really take a better look at, because our power grid is absolutely disgraceful.
Well, and what's the likelihood that the police themselves might just desert and be part of the chaos because they figure that it's, you know what I'm saying?
I don't see that being a high probability that the police would just desert, okay? Again, depending on how long it lasts, people have their breaking points. So you would have to take that on a case-by-case basis. But for something that we would be able to manage and that we'd be able to get that power grid back up and going again, no, I don't see any police deserting or anything like that.
Because it's probably not long enough. And if it was, the military might come involved or something.
If it came to be that big of a problem where we had all sorts of riots going on and things of that nature, obviously the military would definitely get involved in it.
Okay, and is that some of the stuff that you help with governments now and different organizations now is for problems such as that?
Yes, things such as that. And I also, as a matter of fact, I just got back from St. Kitts, a country in the Caribbean not too long ago, and they're having a problem with homicides over there. So we had a symposium, and I talked to the prime minister, and I was talking to the police chiefs over there, and we were coming up with solutions to try to stop this homicide and drug problem that they're having. So I go not only across the country, but I go around the world advising people on crises.
Well, with the level of poverty rising and with our financial situation, are you seeing homicide increasing or more crimes that deal with survival type crimes?
No, I see violent crime increasing across the country, and I don't know if it's so much economics at this point, but the feeling of policing in this country has changed considerably. So I believe that when there's a perception of police losing respect with the community, and people will take advantage of that, and you'll see the homicides go up in that fashion, because it does give the criminal a kind of like a safety net, saying, hey, the police are hated this much, so even if we do this, it most likely will fall back on the police and it will be their fault. So the criminals are pretty savvy, knowing the climate that's out there. So I think they, in a lot of cities, are taking advantage of that.
And is it working? Is it really going back on them, or is it just kind of a false, false sense of that because of our media?
Well, of course it's a false sense because of the media, but perception is everything, and you know that. So
yes.
If it's perceived to be that way, then it is going to be that way. And that's why I've been noticing when I'm looking at the crime trends throughout the country, I see violent crime going up in a lot of these major cities.
Well, and how much of that is just related to drugs? Whenever there is a more free-flowing drug availability, doesn't violent crimes go up? As well as whenever there's the poverty and the unemployment goes up and, jobs are scarce, violent crimes go up as well during that period, I would think.
Well, yeah, you have to understand right now in this country also, we have a heroin epidemic.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be back to talking with Keith Singer and Crisis Management in a moment.
What if we really didn't have to die to go to heaven? Are you curious about the afterlife or rebirth? The highly anticipated new book from author Dr. Susan Allison, You Don't Have to Die to Go to Heaven, is available now. Find out how to find guidance and healing in the spirit realms. Order the book today and put it on your must-read list for 2016. Visit drsusanallison.com to learn more.
Introducing the Lucid Planet, a digital gathering place featuring cutting-edge, high-vibrational content that will empower and inspire you to become the greatest version of yourself. Visit the Lucid Planet today to stimulate your mind, body, and soul as you connect with a global community of like-minded people. The Lucid Planet is edited by renowned psychologist and author Dr. Kelly Neff, who is here to help you cope with anxiety, connect to your higher purpose, uncover your true passions, and live your dreams. Dr. Kelly's fresh, compassionate perspective emphasizes growth, transformation, healing, and thriving, even in the face of adversity. Say goodbye to bad news and low vibrational media for good, and become part of the larger collective of people working together to navigate the global shift of consciousness and transform the world from within. Join the planet, the Lucid Planet. Visit thelucidplanet.com. Welcome home.
Welcome back to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and we are rejoining with Keith Singer, the former NYPD commanding officer.
And that heroin epidemic is being caused because the government is not securing that southern border all too well. So we are getting a tremendous amount of heroin that's coming into this country. And unfortunately, what's happening was that the people who were addicted to the prescription medication, okay, since those prescription medication pills have gone up considerably in the last couple of years, and heroin is so cheap that people are now opting for the heroin. So a lot of kids are using the heroin and things of that nature. So yes, when you see an epidemic such as heroin, as we're seeing now across the country, yes, crime will also go up.
Well, yeah, and heroin, if we all recall, was really plentiful before Afghanistan, the Taliban got in control, and then the Taliban got in control and cut it off. And then we took over Afghanistan, and within a year, the heroin supply was up again, which is part of the problem with, I mean, the Taliban was not a great group of people. I'm not advocating for the Taliban, but it was something that just didn't get taken care of in Afghanistan.
Well, that's true also, but we're getting a substantial amount of heroin also coming in from the Mexican cartels and the Colombian organized crime. So, I mean, it's coming in every which way but loose on that southern border.
Yeah, I can imagine. And that's part of what the people are fighting with. We got to shut down that border, or at least have control over that border.
Yeah, the border needs to be secure for sure.
Well, what, you talked about 9/11, and what was your role on that terrible day that you all experienced in New York there?
So, I was a sergeant at the time, and I headed a team that was for rescue and recovery. So our first mission was to see if anybody was still alive and try to rescue them and try to get to the places where they would be, whether they'd be buried or under some steel and things of that nature.
So that was, were you the lead on all of that that day?
Well, I was the immediate supervisor for the team, and then I had a lieutenant that I needed to report to, and so on and so on and so on.
Okay. And how many teams were there at that time?
Excuse me?
How many teams, groups of?
There were hundreds of groups.
Okay.
That.
So you had your own part of the NYPD. You had your own group.
Yeah. And then unfortunately, as time went by, it stopped becoming a rescue situation and started becoming a recovery situation. So if we were able to, find bodies, to be able to identify, or body parts to be able to identify to let the families know, that was our role at that point.
Were body parts, I know this is an awful thing to talk about, but were body parts more readily available than anything else?
Yes, body parts were being found, yes.
And that's because people were jumping out of the buildings, correct?
Well, that's correct, yes.
Because if they stayed in the building, then you wouldn't find anything, I would think.
No, not necessarily so. I mean, if they were in the building and the building collapsed on top of them, and they passed away that way, and they were in between, you know, beams and metal and stuff like that, then, you know, you might not get the full body, but you could get a body part. So exactly where the body, how the body parts came about, whether they were in the building or jumped out of the building, is anybody's guess. But you also have to remember the people that did jump out of those buildings, unfortunately, when they hit, the street, it was like grapes.
Oh, that's awful.
So
it was such a high distance.
Yes, very high, very, very high.
And it was just massive. I mean, I don't think people realize the size of that area and the destruction that occurred there.
Yeah, I mean, the best way I would be able to describe it is when I remember growing up and looking at pictures of, Europe during World War II, and that's what you felt like you were in. You felt like you were in a war zone. That was kind of like the end of the world situation of the appearance of all downtown Manhattan. So, no, it was bad. It was very bad.
Was it very scary? Were you scared at that point? Yeah, I know you had a job to do and things, but was the tone of one of fright? Were people fairly scared?
I believe it was one of focus. I mean, at that point, when something like that happens, I think fear is in the back of the mind, but in the front of the mind is focus, and you're focused on the mission, and the mission was to get people out or to try to save people. So I don't think you even had a chance to think about being scared. You were just so focused in trying to get people recovered or try to get people's body parts so we'd be able to identify them and let the family know and bring some closure to the family.
Did you have to deal directly with any families at that point?
No, I did not. That was not what I did.
That would have been a very difficult thing to deal with.
Yeah, that's something I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to have done.
I just remember the news anchor. Remember when they had all those sheets up on the? It's one of the hardest things for me to watch is they had all those signs up on buildings looking for their loved ones, and they're just all looking. They were desperately looking for their loved ones. And I remember a CNN anchor, and I can't remember her name at this point, but she was interviewing the people, and she just lost it and started crying on air because it was – and I can see why she did. It was – these people were just so badly wanted to find their loved ones. It was a hard thing.
It was definitely stressful, and it was definitely something that I would never want to go through again.
Well, how do you believe America changed due to 9/11?
Well, America changed substantially after 9/11. Then we went to war in Afghanistan. We went to a war in Iraq. We had taken out Saddam Hussein, which after that kind of caused a vacuum in Iraq for terrorists to get into Iraq. It kind of threw the stability off because Saddam Hussein at that particular time was keeping Iran in check, and they were busy with each other. And then after that, after the Bush administration, the Obama administration, then, Libya, the Gaddafi, took out Gaddafi.
They just kept moving on to different countries.
just taking out. Now, I'm not saying that Gaddafi are nice people. Don't get me wrong. However, when you take these people out, you have to understand what you might get in place of them is not much better.
Well, we got to think of what the consequences are of what we're trying to do. Because I know when we went into Iraq, we were very, very, very good at taking out, going in there on military combat. But we were dismal and awful at dealing with the consequences afterwards and restructuring and putting something back into place. And in fact, we were so bad we put in, people who just graduated from college to figure out their whole transit system and things like that. And it was almost like we didn't care about the aftermath, but we were just amazing at taking them down. And that's something that we need to improve on if we really – that's national security. If you're not good at doing all that stuff, then you're exposing yourself to even more risk.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, in something like that, you have to take each step into consideration. And whatever step you do use, you have to think of the unintended consequences. I do it all the time with my job when I'm dealing with a crisis. If I'm going to tell one of my clients that we should do A, B, C, and D, before I tell them we should do A, B, C, and D, I think of those unintended consequences that might arise because of the plan that I have or the things I'm telling my clients to do.
But that's exactly what you do, right? I mean, the big bulk of your job is figuring out what the consequences of this stuff. It's not always a direct, easy solution. And when you're dealing with politics and people and all sorts of things, you have to be able to understand the consequences and the politics and the neighborhoods that you're dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. Like, for instance, I mean, even when you're in a neighborhood, that doesn't mean it's one neighborhood, all of the same people. You might be dealing with five different origins of people from five different countries with five different ways of doing things with five different languages. So, yeah, I mean, when you're putting a plan in place, one size does not fit all. You really have to look at who the plan is for. And then you have to take it by step-by-step basis. And, you have to be very meticulous, and before you follow through with the plan, you have to make sure all those I's are dotted and all those T's are crossed, without doubt.
And, you know, basically what they need is someone like you to help with some of the country stuff. Obviously, you don't know the details. You can learn it, but you need somebody else to help you with the cultural issues. But someone like you with coupled with understanding the local cultures to be able to know what to do in an aftermath. Or even as different steps go on, you probably like want to plan each step of the way to make sure you contain it as you go. You don't like bomb it all out and then deal with it. You kind of do it as you go too, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. You want to pre-plan, and then you want your plan of action, and then you definitely want, if that plan of action doesn't work, you need alternatives also. So it's just not like, hey, I got a plan and this is the one we're going to go with. Okay, how if that plan doesn't work? Is there an alternative? Do you have a secondary plan? Do you have a third plan? So these are all the things that, you know, you have to think about when dealing with crises.
We have to take a short station break, and we will be back in a moment.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Pat. The ancient Inca root vegetable maca is world-renowned for its wide array of health benefits. As a family-run company of true maca specialists, the maca team's mission is to provide you with fresh, organic, premium-quality maca powders at a fair price. Amazing. All of the products are always organically grown, fair-traded, GMO-free, fresh, and potent. So don't take my word for it. Experience the life-changing benefits of maca today. Visit themacateam.com.
There are so many resources out there for meditation. But did you know that Atana's Heart Earth Healing Meditation is available for you for free? Yes, that's right. You can receive this free healing meditation today from Atana Badili. All you need to do is visit his website, atanamethod.com. That's ATANAMethod.com. And sign up. You will receive your free meditation instantly. That's atanamethod.com.
Are you ready for a game changer? Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in to Business Game Changers Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Tune in to Sheer Alchemy with Leslie Fontaine on TransformationTalkRadio.com and get ready to stir up your passions, remove your blocks, and shift into an entirely new existence. Speaker, teacher, channel, clairvoyant, Leslie Fontaine is a transformation catalyst who channels a powerful energy from Source to catapult listeners into living the life they were born to live. Whether it's shifting from scarcity to abundance, from emotional pain into joy, or from illness into health, Leslie will help you step into the true essence and power of all that you are with the help of the Ascended Masters and Archangels. You will not be the same. Visit TransformationTalkRadio.com for show dates and times and LeslieFontaine.com to say yes to explosive abundance.
Tune in to the Angels and Answers Psychic Radio Show with clairvoyants Artie Hoffman and Sky Siegel every Thursday for a two-hour show, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Transformation Talk Radio. Artie and Sky deliver spiritual and motivational messages with passion and a sense of humor. Call in 800-930-2819 for live and on-air readings. Visit ArtieHoffman.com and SkyOfAngels.com.
Welcome back to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and we are rejoining with Keith Singer, the former NYPD commanding officer.
Yeah, well, it's just so important because then the crisis turns into a bigger crisis, right?
So that's the whole thing. So my job is basically I get in there and I make sure that that crisis doesn't hit that boiling point. I'm the one that kind of simmers down that heat so that pot doesn't overflow when it's boiling. So that's what I do. I try to hit the crisis before it reaches the boiling point.
And that's kind of what's going on in the Middle East, if you think about it, is that we didn't really deal with the crisis issues, and so now it's exploding into, I mean, the crisis issues are never really dealt with, and so it just keeps exploding into boiling points.
Without a doubt.
So Do you believe, and this is something I have to ask you, since you were so actively involved in 9/11, and then afterwards, as you got promoted a few times and you became in charge of dealing with some of the big things that occurred in New York City, do you believe the official stories as to what actually occurred on 9/11? Because there are so many, you know, around the internet and things, and there's large groups of people that are questioning, especially Building 7. They have radio podcasts that are dedicated to Ed Eisner, I think, is dedicating a podcast to just what's going on with Building 7, because people just don't believe the official stories coming out of the government.
Right. And in regard to Building 7, the NIST's analysis did suggest that was a progressive collapse, meaning that it was a process which the failure of the parts of the structure ultimately created the strains that caused the entire building to come down. So, for instance, I mean, you had debris from the actual towers hitting Building 7. Apparently, there was a couple of fires that were in Building 7. So, you know, and also the way Building 7 was structured, it did have an unusual structure because, according to the NIST, there was one primary reason for that building's failure was this unusual design that it had. And the columns near the visible kinks were carrying exceptionally large loads. I would say roughly around 2,000 square feet of floor area for each floor. So the analysis showed that if you take out just one of those columns on the lower floors, then it's going to cause a vertical progression of collapse so that the entire section comes down.
So do you think that maybe there was another factor, a secondary explosion that somebody planned to take out one of the foundation things with Building 7?
No. I think with all the things that I said, you know, coupled with the debris of the towers hitting Building 7 and the fires within Building 7, and then just the structural damage that Building 7 had, no, I don't believe that there was any secondary devices in Building 7.
Okay. Well, what do you think about the fact that people are really questioning the government's official stories? Do you think the trust of the government has really come to an all-time low based on just the fact that what they sometimes put out and what other media sources and things uncover is not quite, it doesn't really connect?
Yes. Now, you're talking to a person that really, really does not trust government. So let me just put that out there right away. I don't. And I believe, and especially you could see with what's happening in the elections, people lost trust in our government, without a doubt. And people don't particularly believe a lot of stuff that our government says when it comes to major incidents and things of that nature. However, with that said, and when we talk about 9/11, I mean, if you're going to be looking into a conspiracy regarding 9/11, the amount of people that would need to be involved in it, it's too much that it would be able to be kept quiet, especially in a day and age where nothing is kept quiet.
Yeah, and I think with 9/11, I think what the disturbing thing is not necessarily that, you know, maybe it's not some government's conspiracy to do something bad, more that whatever did happen, we didn't get the clear picture on it, I think. Because when you look at the evidence, you know, and I have an engineering background, and you look at some of the stuff, and it just doesn't, you know, some of these people are questioning, and it's like, wow, yeah, they're right. Some of these things really are, just doesn't jive with what the government's saying. And so then what happens is when you don't get that transparency, then people's brains start to just really, you know, that's when the imagination kicks in, and you start thinking, okay, well, why would they do that? And that's the problem when the government's not honest, and when there are so many cover-ups, and when things are so convoluted, is that when you lose the trust of the people, then that's when all these other stories come into play. And that's almost a national security issue as well, because then other countries can plant things, and you can, now you got the people turning against itself.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with it. Like I said, I'm a person that does not trust the government, in particular with 9/11, when government officials came out and specifically had told the rescue workers that the air was okay down there, and it wasn't okay down there, and a lot of people are getting sick now because of it.
Exactly.
I absolutely believe that, yeah, the people have lost trust in the government. And it's kind of like when you tell, your children, hey, you can't lie, because if you lie too much, and then that particular time when you're telling me the truth, I don't know if it's the truth or not.
Well, you have to protect yourself. And so at that point, I'm not, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. You know, it comes to that. And so people are starting to go, well, gosh, I got to protect myself. And if the government's not going to tell me the truth, I got to make sure I protect me and my family. And I think that's the danger of having, not having the transparency and not telling the truth. It's just so important.
No, without a doubt. And like I always say to my clients regarding with dealing with crisis management, and the first thing I'll say is this, is, you know, if you did in fact do this, okay, you need to tell the truth, because the truth is going to come out, and what usually is worse is not the actual act that happened.
Exactly.
It's the cover-up that ensues afterwards that gets people in trouble. So sometimes you have to take that medicine and say, hey, listen, I was wrong. This is why I was wrong. We're doing steps A, B, C, and D to take corrective action. And the public will believe you more. It's kind of like Chipotle. Chipotle totally screwed up that situation because they weren't transparent. They
exactly.
weren't telling the public in a timely fashion. They didn't have a plan of action to take care of the problem. And they were the ones that were saying, oh, our food is fresh. And that was their brand. And over a couple of months, their brand was ruined because they didn't have a plan and they weren't transparent and they weren't telling the whole truth.
Yeah, you just got to come clean. There's and I wish I had this in front of me, but I remember reading a research article on a hospital in Chicago area that when it comes to making mistakes with surgeries and patients and things, they just come clean and they deal with it up front and they apologize and say, I'm really sorry. This, you know, we made a mistake or whatever. And you know what they found is that most of the time the families are understanding. People don't want to sue in most cases. If the hospital, you know, they're all doing the best and they're all well-meaning people and, you know, we really thought this would work and it didn't. Instead of covering everything up, they're just really open about it. And they have found that their lawsuits have gone down, their cost of doing business has gone down. And it's a wonderful case study for people to look at because it shows, you know, the power of truth and just saying, hey, this is what, and then people want to go there. People would rather have their loved ones there because they know that they're dealing with honesty and, you know, integrity and people that are doing the best they can. And so
without a doubt, you're 100% right, Sarah. And it kind of brings me back to, the Virgin Airlines. Do you remember when Virgin Airlines was doing space exploration, and the first time that they tried to put one of their rockets up with people in it, it blew up. Right?
Sure.
It was a failure. However, the way they handled that situation, the way the CEO of Virgin Airlines handled that situation was unbelievable. He was right out in front, right in front of the media, telling the media everything that happened, what went wrong, what they're going to do to correct it, and things of that nature. So that's why you didn't see that crisis stay in the papers for that long, or it didn't really harm that organization reputation, because I think people understood, hey, yeah, if you're going to be doing research and development on space exploration, you're going to have some hiccups along the way. And I think
it's part of the deal. It's part of the thing. And I think that's why he is so highly recognized. You're talking about Richard Branson, and he's very well respected in the business world. And it's, you know, I teach a class, entrepreneur class at the Carlson School of Business at the University of Minnesota. And I ran a video of him just, you know, leadership lessons from him he did some talk on leadership, and he's just a great individual. And there's something that he's somebody that you can learn a lot from just on the way he conducts himself. But, you know, speaking of that, with all the different things that you've done, what are some of the main lessons that you've learned personally from all your experiences at the NYPD? Because I know that dealing with crises over a long period of time has to bring you wisdom and maturity of dealing with all the things that you have to deal with.
Yes. So the lessons that I definitely learned from the NYPD is that when you're dealing with the crisis, first of all, you need to scan. You need to get all the information. What's going on? Get your facts straight. Because if it's that big of a crisis and you need to be in front of those cameras explaining yourself to the media, you want all facts. You don't want innuendos. You don't want rumors. What you want is the facts. So when you're out there in front of the cameras, you can tell the facts. If you do not know the facts at the time, just tell the media. Don't know yet, but we will get back in, you know, we'll get back in contact with you when we do have that answer.
Unfortunately, we need to take another quick break, and we will be back in a moment.
Do you want the freedom to spend more time with your loved ones? Travel the world? Live spontaneously? Get ready, because the Chip Justice Show is here. Hosts Dr. Pat Basile and Chip Justice can help you build meaningful success while embracing life. Living a life you love is the end game in this new, inspirational, and empowering show. Positive changes for a life you'll love. Tune in every month on TransformationTalkRadio.com and visit PositiveChangeInstitute.co for more information.
Are you ready for a game changer? Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in to Business Game Changers Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
What are vibes? We often use this word, but did you know vibes can actually be useful and help solve our everyday challenges? Embark on an exciting learning journey with Caitlin Keat, 11-time Visionary Award winner, specialist in vibrational energy, and the creator of Vibes Up. Join Caitlin as she takes you through the world of vibrational therapy and energy healing with natural solutions for a modern world. Visit vibesup.com to learn more today.
Welcome back to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and we are talking with Keith Singer, and he was sharing with us what to do in a crisis and how to manage that properly. And we'll be returning to the interview now.
The second is, and you know, you have to do an analysis. And now, you know, what, you know, where was the genesis of the crisis? How did the crisis get to be this big? Is there any one person or people that we should point to that led to the crisis and things of that nature? And then once you have all those facts and you did all your research and you know what you're talking about, then you have to respond. And this might not be one response. You should come up with several different responses just in case if that one response doesn't work. And then after you respond, then you really have to step back. You have to see, you have to assess and say, okay, did it work? Now, if it didn't work, obviously, you got to choose another response and take another course of action. So what I learned was you really need to take your time with these things. I know there are some crises which are very fluid, and I know it moves very fast, but if you can try to slow down the situation as much as possible, that is the best thing to do because, you know, if you're going too fast, you're not thinking, then you're going to give out bad information, and in the long run, you're going to look bad yourself.
Yeah, you have to make sure that you're poised under pressure, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think poise is a good word for that. So how are you using this experience to help executives and government leadership?
Well, what I do with, for instance, for the personal crisis management, I'll do your crisis analysis for you. I'll do the crisis response for you, and I'll do the post-crisis follow-up. For corporate, what I'll do is I do crisis management preparation.
What do you mean? What do you mean for personal? Like you would actually work with a family that's dealing with a personal crisis?
Well, absolutely.
Like, what would be an example of something that you would work with on a with people, like personal level?
Okay, so for instance, now for personal, this touches me personal because I have twin boys who are 8 years old right now.
Oh, that's awesome! And, you got your hands full, but that's fun.
And they were born at 25 weeks, and it was called a twin to twin transfusion syndrome. So basically what had happened was the blood supply was not being shared equally between the identical twins, and one child wasn't getting enough and the other child was getting too much. However, the child that was getting too much, it led to congestive heart failure.
Mm.
So they were in the NICU for 4 months. So it was touch and go, and I remembered going through that and my wife going through that and just remembering, you feel so alone in such a dark place, you know, nothing is in your control. And when you're going through that, people aren't thinking, you could be the smartest person in the world, but when you're going through a crisis, you're not thinking smart. Sometimes you think irrational because you're under so much stress and so much pressure. So I'm the person that would come in. I'm the objective voice for you. I'm like, hey, listen, been through this. I've been through crises before. This is what we need to do. Don't worry. You have somebody on your side, and that somebody is me.
And you don't want to make rash decisions that could be a big financial disaster for you and your family, or just a general disaster. You know, if you have high stakes decisions that you need to make, you have to be really careful doing it under those conditions, right? And that's where. Go ahead.
Yeah, without a doubt, and especially not only personal, but when you're dealing with corporate or even policing. I mean, look at the San Bernardino attacks that they had. I mean, if the San Bernardino Police Department didn't handle it the way they handled it, it could have been much worse. I mean, they were prepared, they were trained, they had a good response. As a matter of fact, at the time they were doing drills near the shooting, and after the shooting happened, they had a message. They had a message to the public, and they were good with their updates with the public, and they were being transparent, and they were telling the truth and things of that nature. So when I advise corporations, that's exactly what I do. I have a crisis management preparation plan for them. I'll do crisis training with them, crisis response and crisis drills. Like we'll do it, like I'll come in, we'll do it, I'll give a scenario and I'll do a tabletop situation, a scenario of a crisis and, you know, see who the crisis management team is. Who is the person that's speaking with the one voice to tell the people what actually is going on? Who's speaking to the actual employees to make sure they know what's going on? What are you saying over social media? Are you using your social media? A lot of these corporations, when it comes to a crisis, they just want to pretend social media doesn't even exist anymore, but that's where a lot of people get their information. So you must use social media. So that's how I help our corporations also.
Well, and you have to refrain from doing, you know, impulse revenge things and something that you can't fight with these people. You have to, and it might be hard because they're personally attacking you. And so you have to back up. And if you're the one being personally attacked and you can't separate yourself from it, that's where someone like you can come in and say, okay, hey, wait a minute here. You cannot do this. I know that your instinct is to lash out, but you can't do that.
Absolutely. I'm the person that comes in. I'm the one that gives you the objective voice.
Having someone like you come in is really helpful for celebrities and people because the media is so unwieldy.
Yeah, absolutely. Like so for instance, what I would do, I'm the person, like I said, I come in and I give the situation an objective look, and I tell you what you actually need to hear. Like, you know, point in hand, Alex Rodriguez. Alex Rodriguez was involved with the steroid scandal. Now, when looking at that steroid scandal, you could see that Major League Baseball had a paper trail on Alex Rodriguez. He had Major League Baseball had the people that had sold him the steroids, and Major League Baseball had receipts of things going to his cousin that was accepting the steroids and things of that nature. However, you know, he was being advised by his people totally wrong. They were saying fight it, and he was being advised by his lawyers totally wrong. And the reason why the lawyers were advising him the way they were advising, not because they thought that he was innocent or they thought they had a good case, was because they saw him as a cash cow. And they saw that if they, you know, kept on prolonging it, they would have had a big payday. I mean, I would have come in and I would have told them, I would have assessed the situation and said, hey, listen, you know, you could fight it, but you're not going to win. And if you fight it, you're going to be spending all these millions and millions of dollars. And once it's found once again that you lied, your reputation is going to take even a bigger hit than it took in the first place. So instead of just fessing up to it, taking the penalty, and then coming back, he went through the whole process of lying and getting lawyers involved, and it just totally blew up in his face because the ultimate decision of his was to say that he was guilty.
Well, yeah, because now you have two things. Now, not only did you do the steroids, but now you're also a liar. So instead of just having one problem, but you know, you do need lawyers to make sure now the damages assessed against you is minimized, right? But you,
without a doubt, I'm not saying that people shouldn't have lawyers. You're absolutely right. However, remember, the lawyer is there to guide you. You're the person that's ultimately, it's your life. So you're the person that's ultimately going to have to live with the decision, because after everything is finished and done, the lawyers leave on to the next case. So for something like that, which was so, you know, right in the face that Major League Baseball had the goods on you, you just should have taken your medicine at that particular point, and you should have realized that maybe people didn't have the best interests in mind for you. Maybe they were trying to make as much money as possible, and maybe the other people that were handling him didn't want to say anything bad because maybe they were scared that they would be fired or something like that. So with me, I don't have to worry about that stuff. You hire me. I'm the objective person. If you don't like what you hear and you want to get rid of me, well, so be it. I'll just move on to the next client. But
well, and that's what you need.
Everybody should definitely have a crisis manager.
Well, if you're surrounded with the yes people all day long, you can't. It's just not a very – any business executive or leader needs to have that rational thought next to them because, you know, power corrupts and power – absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that's why it does, is because you're ignorant to what reality really is, and you become corrupt. Now, you're not, it doesn't say that you will have no one ever really can get absolute power, but if you're surrounded with yes people all day long, and then you all of a sudden are thrown into a situation where you don't have the power, and you can't handle, you know, the truth, that's a really hard situation to be in. So you got to be able to feed yourself truth as things go on, otherwise you're going to be delusional.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And, you know, a perfect example of what you just said was the NFL. The NFL, you know, the commissioner apparently had yes people all around him. And when the Ray Rice situation came up, I felt that the commissioner was living in a bubble, didn't think that his decision was going to have the backlash that it did. And they really should have thought that out, especially when the NFL knew there was a videotape out there, and you have to think that videotape would get out. They should have responded much differently, but what exactly what you said. Yes, people all around you, and, you know, you make the most perfect decisions all the time, and when you deal with business like that, more times than not, you're going to get a bad outcome.
Yeah, because you have just no idea what you're walking into.
Exactly.
Well, how can people reach you and learn more about your work?
Okay, great. So my website is www.keithsinger.net. I'll say that one more time, www.keithsinger.net. And once you get onto my website, you can link up to my Facebook, you can link up to my Twitter, my LinkedIn, and About Me page. And my phone number is, if you want to get in contact by phone, it's 929-352-6299.
And I'll have all that information up on my webpage as well so people can get that. But I really appreciate it. I think you have just a really good depth of knowledge here, and it's a very interesting conversation today.
I enjoyed myself, Sarah, and thank you so much for having me on your show. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a wonderful day.
You do the same.
Well, that's all we have with this interview. I hope you enjoyed it today, and I hope you learned something off of this and how to possibly manage a crisis better in your own little neck of the woods. And if you need to reach out to him or if you want more questions, go to my website, sarahwestall.com, and I have his contact information up there as well. And for now, I hope everyone has a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific Time. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.